Hey, this is Andrew, and I'm walking around the campus of Loyola University. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It is great to be here with you today for show number 956. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. So hello to Bob. And we have quite the show for you today. We discover the secret history of a local 1960s garage band called the Monteras from our good pal at the Chicago Reader, Steve Krakow. And speaking of the Reader, we explore what is happening with that local paper. And this gets to something near and dear to my heart, and quite frankly, I hope it's near and dear to yours too, independent journalism. I know. News is everywhere. You got your Twitter, your TikTok, that family member who gets headlines from online memes, and all of those were most likely fact-checked by absolutely no one. But let's be real. If you want to actually understand what's happening in Chicagoland, beyond just the Bears draft picks and whether or not Malort will ever be palatable, you need independent journalism. By the way, they're making a non-alcoholic Malort now. Why? I mean, do people not like themselves? What are we doing here? This leads us to the Chicago Reader. That scrappy, beautiful, occasionally weird, but always essential alternative paper that's been chronicling this city's highs and lows and absolute what-the-heck-is-happening moments for over 50 years. The Reader is the paper that tells the stories the big outlets might not touch. You want an expose on corrupt landlords? They got it. A deep dive on the DIY music scene in someone's basement? Oh yeah. A review of a pop-up restaurant that serves tacos inside of donuts while blasting experimental jazz? Absolutely. The Reader is where you go when you want to hear from the artists, activists, and just everyday Chicagoans who make this city tick. But here's the kicker. Independent journalism isn't some magical self-sustaining force. It needs support. And unfortunately, support does not mean sharing an article on Facebook with the caption, "Wow, this is interesting." No, it means actually paying for news. I know when there's a lot of free content out there, paying for news is tough for a lot of us. But when corporate interests are gobbling up local media outlets faster than Mayor Johnson dodging questions at a press conference, supporting publications like The Reader is how we make sure our city's stories, especially those ground-level stories, get told. Because if we don't support independent journalism, who's going to keep tabs on shady backroom deals at City Hall? Who's going to cover the underground punk scene in a Pilsen laundromat? Who will shed some light on what it's really like to be a barista in Chicago? Who's going to write 2,000 words on why the DIB system is an absolute manifestation of Chicago's greatest and worst instincts? The Reader and local journalism more broadly are part of a love letter to this city, written in ink, sweat, and yeah, maybe some occasional Malort. If you live here, if you care about what happens here, if you've ever used the phrase, "This is why we can't have nice things," when discussing city politics, you need to support local journalism. Subscribe, donate, buy some merch, do whatever you got to do, but do something. Because Chicago without independent journalism is like the CTA without delays. Sure, it's a nice dream, but we all know it's never going to work that way. Let us turn our attention to a cornerstone of our city's journalistic landscape, the Chicago Reader. Established in 1971, the Reader has long been celebrated for its in-depth coverage of arts, culture, and politics, becoming an essential thread of Chicago's media fabric. However, recent developments have cast a shadow over its future. Last month, the publication announced a series of layoffs and restructuring efforts in response to significant financial challenges. These difficulties stem from a combination of declining advertising revenues and philanthropic support, leading to an imminent risk of closure. As the Reader approaches its 54th anniversary, the question looms, what lies ahead for this iconic local publication? Amber Nettles is the publisher of the Chicago Reader. She is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Amber, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You are quite welcome. And the editor-in-chief of the Reader is also joining us, Salem Kahlo-Julin. Salem, welcome. Nice to talk to you.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Man, so much to talk about here. Amber, let's start with you. I mean, I'm clearly a fan of the Chicago Reader, and I think that we should start just by talking about the cultural impact of the paper, because 54 years, that's an amazing run for this kind of scrappy upstart publication. I remember picking up the Reader when I was in college at Loyola University here in Chicago, and boy, that thing was a brick of a paper. I would read that on the red line, and I read it for the long form journalism. I read it for the music reviews. So if you had to think back at this social, political, cultural impact of the paper, I mean, how do we quantify that? What is that impact of the Chicago Reader?
You know, it's really interesting because I'm not originally from Chicago, but I knew of the Reader long before I moved to Chicago almost 8 years ago. Having been in media for about 20 years, the Reader was a touch point for many of us who were looking at alt weeklies, because the Reader was the first free alternative weekly in the U.S. And managed to stay afloat during really turbulent times when Craigslist took over a lot of revenue from classifieds, when the digital transformation really started happening in the mid-2000s. And for me, it's hard to quantify its impact, because I think that it has affected so many different communities, whether it's music or theater or arts, or for me in particular, before I moved here, I knew it because of the journalism and because of its impact, and how it was replicated across the country and how it was looked to as an example of what to do well and how to do it right.
Yeah, that, I think that's interesting, you not being from Chicago originally. But you knew, I mean, you knew of the impact of the Reader, and that was, you know, really well known. And Salem, you know, thinking about journalism as a business, that business has changed over the last 25 years, especially. The Reader is no longer that brick of a paper that I remember in college and would try to go cover to cover with. So in terms of how the Reader has had to adapt to modern times or throughout the last 25 years or so, what is that adaptation? How has the Reader had to change over the years?
Well, I think what you're seeing in the Reader is how local media overall in this country has changed and had to evolve quickly to deal with not only things like emerging technologies. You know, when the Reader was a brick, as you say, with four thick sections, and at one point in the 1990s, a separate suburban edition that was sent out to Cook County and DuPage County suburbs. You know, it was a different time in terms of how people got information, like events listings, and how people got information like job advertisements and even personal ads. You know, we're all dependent on something other than the internet during the early part of those years. And when things like Craigslist came into play, and then now with social media, there's just another layer of ways that people can get this information. But I think that what you'll see, if you're someone who looks at local papers like ours and papers that cover the kinds of things that we do, the culture of a city, the actual people who live in the city, and not always the most famous people, there's a certain dedication to storytelling, and really a dedication to seeing how Chicago has evolved that, you know, keeps a paper like ours relevant and keeps this kind of media relevant. You know, our print editions might be smaller, but the stories that we're telling are still just as important as they were in the 70s and 80s.
That's amazing, because I was going to say, I don't think the coverage is really that different in terms of what you're covering. I mean, you're still looking at city life, you're looking at culture, and I think, you know, Salem, the attitude, the you know, that scrappy kind of, hey, we're not the, although it's a great newspaper, it's laid out wonderfully, but we're not the slick kind of operation. You know, we are this upstart, we are this scrappy kind of outsider, and I mean all of that in a positive way, but I think that a lot of Chicagoans pick it up and they can relate to the tone, because that's how they might see themselves. Like, they might not see themselves fit in on Michigan Avenue or in Lincoln Park or somewhere, you know, in the Loop, right? So they see themselves as kind of like, well, I got some takes, and I think that that tone comes through, and it's amazing, at least where I sit, I don't think that's changed, you know, over the 54 years.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's hard to find in any big city like ours, something that's going to reflect every single voice that makes up, you know, our citizenry. And what the Reader has tried to do over the course of its publication time is to capture voices that a daily paper just can't capture, you know, and a national paper who's kind of flying into Chicago for a second to get a sense of what things look like, you know, is going to really just cover Chicago in a different way, because you often don't have a native Chicagoan, you know, making the choices and asking particular questions. And so I think that we've stayed relevant, and we've stayed a publication that readers really turn to, because we are from here. We are also living here in Chicago. We also want to know, you know, what the concerts are that we should be considering this week. And our writers, and we have so many people who have contributed to us, you know, for decades. Some of our writers have been with us for a very, very long time. Our writers also, I think, take that kind of responsibility very seriously. You know, that we're not only doing journalism here, but we're also making sure that we're sharing very important information with our neighbors, with the other people who make up this great city.
Amber, I know you have some statistics. I wanted to get into like where the Reader is now, but I mean, just looking back on 2024, it was a busy 2024 for the Reader. Tell us about some of the things that we have seen in the Reader as we look back now that we have all the data from 2024, because you guys were busy over there.
Always very busy. And I think sometimes we lose sight of the volume of work that we create to cover the city that we love. And so thank you for asking me the question, because I love sharing this information. And I did share a lot of this in a publisher's note that went in the paper the week before last. But in 2024, we covered 311 theater previews and reviews. We had 202 film and television reviews, 325 music previews and reviews. And things that I think that people don't think about enough is that we commissioned over 1,000 freelance pieces, whether that was written copy or illustrations or photography, from over 490 writers and artists. And so when we talk about our impact, it's the coverage and also the work that we do in the community with other creators. Our music coverage is, I think, unmatched in a lot of ways. We had over 1,600 music shows listed in our early warnings newsletter. And we cover your community and small businesses and small nonprofits and large nonprofits. Over 200 small businesses were written about, over 100 local nonprofit organizations. And so, you know, when we talk about the big picture and the breadth of what we do, we're talking about, I think, a voice for the city and for the community that, you know, we hate that it's in danger.
I want to talk about that danger here, because I said at the outset that there are some big questions thinking about the future of the publication of the Chicago Reader. And can you give us a sense of how dire the situation is that the Reader is in currently, Amber?
Yes, I can. When we announced our layoffs, I was not exaggerating that we were there was an imminent risk of closure for a variety of reasons, most unexpected. I think I used the phrase, it was a perfect storm of multiple things going wrong when it came to revenue and cash flow. Since then, we've cut a third of our budget. We have enacted layoffs for mostly director level positions. Our editorial union and the rest of our team have taken pay cuts and are doing furloughs to make up the deficit that we have currently. So we were able to move forward. And at the time, I couldn't see past a week in terms of our cash flow and making sure that we could cover the bills that we were obligated to pay. Now we are able to see much further out. And the ongoing mantra that we have that I keep saying is, if we get 2 days, I can get four. We get a week, we get 2 weeks. Now that we have 3 weeks, I can see into next month. The more time that we're here and the more ability that we have to right the ship and fix our budget issues, et cetera, the more likely we are to be able to stick around.
So I just want to be clear that it wasn't that long ago that you were really questioning if the Chicago Reader was going to be around, say, the next week or even just in a few days. That's how close to all this ending we came. Is that right?
That's correct. We just finished week three of the situation. And so over the course of 3 weeks, frankly, everyone on the team has worked at a breakneck pace, keeping their foot on the gas pedal, to turn the phrase, to move forward as quickly as possible. A lot of changes had to happen very quickly for us to fix some of the financial problems that we had.
Salem, I want to ask you this. As the editor-in-chief, can you give us a sense of the morale of what's happening here and how this is impacting people that work under you? What is the morale like at the Chicago Reader right now?
I'd say for both my staff and also the other staff members in the organization, there is a sense of anxiety, worry, because of the magnitude of the situation that Amber just addressed. But on the positive side, and also owing to several of us being through different situations like this before, not just at the Reader, but other media outlets. Like, it's an unfortunate thing that we're not the only media outlet who has faced this kind of financial issue, especially in this climate. And over the course of just a few days after the announcements were first made, and internally, we shared with each other as much information as we had about what was going on. I mean, over the course of just those few days, the prevailing conversation was, what do I need to do? How can I help? And that's something that our staff has been first and foremost with since I first started here in 2019 as a part-time staffer. That's something that I've always seen with the editorial staff members that I've worked with. We started a donation campaign, which your listeners can go to chicagoreader.com/donate if they'd like to contribute. And with that, we're using a tool called DonorBox, which allows you to make your own little donation page if you like. So you can write a personal note to all of your friends and family and say, this is why I believe in this publication and this is why you should donate. And after a few of our staff members started making their own, the response to those individual donor campaigns has been something that none of us in management had assumed would happen. It's been just incredible. And it's not just in people actually donating dollars to us, but also in people sharing the message. We've had so many colleagues from other publications in Chicago that have also reached out over these last couple of weeks to just say, hey, we're so sorry you're going through this. Let us know how we can help. Can we share services with you? Is there something that you need a hand with? And that's not the story that a lot of people hear about media outlets. You know, when I was growing up, I'm Generation X, and I still grew up with like the memories of, you know, kind of 1940s newsrooms with people pushing each other out of the way to get the story and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so I think that's how a lot of us my age were trained about how news works. And I'm so happy that the experience that that we're having in the crisis is completely the opposite. You know, I think there's a lot of media outlets here in Chicago that believe the same thing that I do, which is we need more of us. We need more Chicago readers. We need more community news. We need more local media outlets because we need, you know, we need all of these stories to be told. So we need more radio, we need more podcasts, we need more of everything, because we can see what happens when there's only one news source and it's dictated by one person or company. It just doesn't work out.
Yeah, and you know what you're saying here, you're anxious, everyone there, but there is hope, and I think that comes through. And boy, isn't that, you know, I understand what you're saying, Salem, like, yeah, the 1940s newsrooms, we're going to get the story and we're going to scoop these other people. But yeah, it's so Chicago, I think, when you have people come together in this community to try to help you out. And that, I think, is something that is really, we talk about how do you cover Chicago? How do you define Chicago? How do you voice that? That is happening. You have people coming to try to support you. And we can all go to chicagoreader.com/donate. If you feel strongly about the reader, you can donate. But you've got people in the community coming together, coming out of the woodwork maybe, and saying, this matters to me. And I've always, for so long, talked about the future here on this show of independent journalism and what does that look like. And, you know, I'll ask that question, but I think it's a lot different when something that you love so much and that you rely on is going through such a tough time. So, Amber, I'll ask you this question. I mean, are you optimistic going forward about the reader and independent journalism in general?
Oh, what a question. Yeah, I am optimistic. And that's, frankly, I don't think any of us could work this hard if we didn't see the future and see that we could be successful in our efforts. I don't think that we're built for that. We're doing all of this, and the Salem and the rest of the editorial team, our marketing team, and the people on the leadership team, we are working this hard because we truly believe that we can see the path forward, that we can be here in 6 months, a year, 50 years. I couldn't put this much time and effort into this if I didn't think that it could pay off. We feel like we have an obligation to do everything within our power to make sure that we're still standing, to continue to serve the community in the way that we have for so long, to make sure that we can employ the freelancers and our staff and write about the people that in our communities that you wouldn't know about otherwise. It's a huge responsibility that we take incredibly seriously.
And what a gift. I mean, an absolute gift that you're able to do this. And I am thrilled. I mean, I get to do what we're doing now on the radio and podcasting, but to be able to talk to you both, because really you are kind of at the helm of this iconic publication. I keep using that phrase, but it means a lot to a lot of people, myself included. I'm a fan, and I want to see the reader continue here. I know that you're both very busy, and so I just want to say thank you so much for talking to us today. Amber Nettles, the publisher of the Chicago Reader, and Salem Kahlo-Julin, the editor-in-chief at the Reader, chicagoreader.com/donate. Seriously, thank you for your time. I know that you're running around, you're working 7 days a week, and you're trying to get that product out. It is a wonderful product, and I am optimistic that this will continue. So thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Mike. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Chicago Reader, you will see the column The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
once again connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip, in the Chicago Reader online at chicagoreader.com. And I know you love this music, Steve. I love this music. Some good old-fashioned local garage band tunes from the 1960s. You are profiling a band called The Monteras. The Monteras. It's a cool sound. It's kind of like this classic sound by now, you know?
It is. And yeah, as you said, the sort of innocent teenagers making music in their garage or basement in the 60s, sort of copying the British invasion bands to the best of their ability. It's an endearing one for me. And, you know, I've more or less made it my mission to cover every such band in Chicago. You know, I like the jazz and the soul and the funk, but this is one I gotta go like kind of top to bottom with, you know?
Absolutely. I dig the tunes. There's something pure about it. It's not spruced up. It is very much what you hear is what was being recorded. the fuzz.
You know, it's the folk music of its time and place, you know, if you really think about it, because it says a lot about the people creating it, you know?
Amen to that. Well, let's talk about the origins of this band, The Monteras. So this is, you know, a couple of kids getting together. Tell us about the origin story going up to the north side of Chicago for this one.
Yeah, you know, it's a pretty typical tale in that, you know, friends from school, you know, and, you know, they sort of go through grammar school together and on to high school. And there was also a lot of, in the day, these sort of battle of the bands. And not only did they sort of judge who was the best band, sometimes they made the bands form just to be in the battle of the bands. And that's kind of more or less how the Monteras started. They were like, there's a battle of the bands, we could win $100, let's start a band, you know, which is a great sort of, as you said, innocent sort of reason to start a band, you know, and do a couple covers of, you know, bands you liked and stuff. So that is more or less how they started.
That's right. So we're looking at good old Gordon Tech High School. It's now DePaul College Prep. I remember Gordon Tech. I've visited Gordon Tech a couple of times when I was on the speech team in school because I was a cool guy. Love to the speech team.
But the coolest kids were on the speech team,
that's
right?
That's right. And hey, look what I'm doing now. So joke's on you, everybody.
You're a speech success story.
There it is. So I've been to Gordon Tech, now DePaul College Prep, although I think the original Gordon Tech is now, I don't know what it is, but I think it moved. So, all right, that's the school. So this, again, like a couple of students, couple of kids, friends getting together. And tell us how this gets off the ground. The Monteras, as you write here, as I've read, kind of like a version of a car, right?
Yeah. I was kind of wondering, you know, what the name reference was, but a lot of time, you know, a lot of bands name themselves after cars, you know, from the olden days to modern, probably. And I guess it is sort of a variation on Mercury had a car called the Monterey. But there was already a band called the Monterays based on the car. So they were like, let's call it the Monteras, you know, and that sort of became, you know, which sounds cool enough. And, it's a reference to something, but it really all sort of came together. You know, these kids were like 14 or something, you know, starting this band around, you know, various high schools on the Northwest side. But a sort of older kid that they knew came along and he had a little more experience and he sort of brought the name with him from his lat. He had sort of given it up, gone away to college, saw, you know, his young friends doing this and was like, oh, I should join this band. And, you know, sort of like became their, you know, like 18-year-old mentor, you know, to right. these, like, and then brought his little sister in the band to play organ, who was basically the same age as Joe Mollen and some of these other guys who were in the band.
Right. So Joe Mollen was the only member of the Monteras old enough to drive. So he's driving to the gigs. And we're talking like, I mean, they're playing around Chicago, but they're also playing basements. They're playing anniversary parties. It really is like the neighborhood kid band, just kind of getting out there and having a good time.
Yeah, and then they're good, you know, on top of it. And they're doing these cool, you know, sort of, you know, kind of, you know, dare I say, kind of edgy. I mean, the 45, the 145 that they were able to record, one side is like really snarly and sort of punk. And then the other side is sort of like innocent and, you know, has a sort of, it almost harkens back to more the early 60s kind of simpler times vibe, you know?
When I'm alone and blue, and just when I need you, but then when you come to me, you're nothing but a tease. You're a tease. You say you've come to love me, and that you've been thinking of me.
Yeah, and this was something that struck me when I read this in your column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. They say, Joe Mollins says, we played in the schoolyard at my old elementary school on a flatbed truck in the parking lot at Belmont and Cumberland for the opening of the Zayer department store.
I would not make that up.
I mean, I remember that place. I grew up in Elmwood Park, not far from there. I remember the good old Zayers.
We even had Zayer out in the suburbs. And it's kind of funny, by that time, they had sort of fallen a bit. And it was sort of like there was almost like a hierarchy. It was like Kmart was tops. Venture was second.
Yep.
Zayer was at the bottom. Like, you went into the Zayer toy aisle, and it just looked like a tornado went through it. You know, it was like everything was out of the package, laying on the floor and stuff. They clearly never cleaned it up very often or anything. It was a mess, you know. So, like, I couldn't even believe they were actually called a department store at one point.
Long live the Zayers, man. Long live the Zayers. So, all right, yeah. The Monteras, they're in the late 1960s here. So, how big do they get around Chicagoland?
You know, not, you know, winning this battle of the bands in Itasca.
Nice.
You know, that in a way seems like their crowning moment of glory. And that got them recorded. And it was a near scam. It was like you paid for the studio time and then you got a single. May, you know, like you got like couple hundred singles of like what you recorded. No time to overdub, no time to fret about anything. You just laid it down quickly and you paid for it, but you got this gift of these 45s that you could sling at your gigs at Zayer, you know, for like a dollar, you know. So, like, it, and of course, so this label that would do this, Orlin, it now, those are like the rarest garage singles because, like I said, there's only a couple hundred of these. Now, these things go for like, I'm not kidding you, literally thousands of dollars, some of them.
Wow.
They're so coveted because, A, they're this very pure example of like a garage band just doing it for real raw, you know, like in their 2 hours of studio time, you know, that won this battle of the band and was deemed the best. And because they're just so rare, you know, they're like, it wasn't like something pressed on Dunwich Records or USA Records or one of these little bit bigger, you know, sort of garage band type labels in Chicago. They're so, like, now they just go for like a fortune. Like the Montera single has gone for over $1,000.
Wow, that's amazing. So the Monteras, they play
so big in that. In a way, yeah. They're bigger now, you know,
right.
That it's so coveted, you know, and you know, the band probably has like two copies left or something, you know, but
so the Monteras, they play their last show in 1969. They play their last show in 1969. And that is pretty much the end for that band. But they were about to play a gig at Triton College with the Crying Shames, the American Breed. But they lost a battle at the State Fair. That's their last show, 1969, huh?
Yeah, you know, just fizzled out. And, you know, I'm sure people went on to like college and stuff. But that said, Joe Mollen and the drummer, John Schofield, who was he gave the band a little bit of an edge because he was a little more like jazz school. They started this kind of horn rock band called Heaven and Earth that Joe sent me a picture of. And they look really cool, but I don't think they recorded anything, you know. But bass player, rhythm guitarist guy had a couple other bands later on, too. But, you know, yeah, you know, it just, I think it just sort of was a teenage thing. Also, the style kind of went out of style, you know, like they tried adapting to like the sort of heavier acid rock sound that started coming into the later 60s. But, you know, that requires some gear and chops and all this kind of stuff, too. So, like, not every band could sort of make that transition. A lot did, though. A lot did.
Yeah. Well, the Monteras. Some good stuff, some garage rock from the north side of Chicago, and we can read the full story of the Monteras in the Secret History of Chicago Music Strip in the Chicago Reader and online at chicagoreader.com. I love the tunes. Steve, I know you love the tunes. Hey, man, I always appreciate the time. You keep it up here. You keep rocking in the garage, and all will be well, right?
All will be well. Let's keep telling ourselves that.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 956 is done. Thank you, as always, for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his wonderful engineering skills in the WGN radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.